in, and it dawned on him that they probably wouldn't even notice if Dee changed him into an elephant right in the middle of downtown Ojai.
"Do you know how long I've been chasing Nicholas Flamel, or Nick Fleming, or any of the hundreds of other aliases he's used?"
Dee continued quietly, conversationally. He leaned back and trailed his fingers through the water.
"At least 500 years, and he's always given me the slip. He's tricky and dangerous that way. In 1666, when I was closing in on him in London, he set a fire that nearly burned the city to the ground."
"He told us you caused the great fire," Josh blurted. Despite his fear, he was curious. And now he suddenly remembered one of the first pieces of advice Flamel had given him.
"Nothing is as it seems. Question everything."
Josh found himself wondering if that advice also applied to the alchemist himself. The sun had set, and there was a definite chill in the evening air. Josh shivered. The three old men shuffled away, none of them even glancing in his direction, leaving him alone with the magician. Strangely, he didn't feel threatened by the man's presence. Dee's thin lips flickered in a smile.
"Flamel never tells anyone everything," he said. "I used to say that half of everything he said was a lie, and the other half wasn't entirely truthful either."
"Nicholas says you're working with the Dark Elders. Once you have the complete codex, you will bring them back into this world."
"Correct in every detail," Dee said, surprising him.
"Though no doubt Nicholas has twisted the story somewhat."
"I am working with the Elders," he continued. "And yes, I am looking for the last two pages from the Book of Abraham the Mage, commonly called the Codex. But only because Flamel and his wife stole it from the original Bibliothèque du Roi in the Louvre."
"He stole it?"
"Let me tell you about Nicholas Flamel," Dee said patiently.
"I'm sure he's told you about me."
"He has been many things in his time, a physician and a cook, a bookseller, a soldier, a teacher of languages and chemistry, both an officer of the law and a thief. But he is now and has always been a liar, a charlatan, and a crook. He stole the book from the Louvre when he discovered that it contained not only the immortality potion, but also the Philosopher's Stone recipe. He brews the immortality potion each month to keep Paranel and himself at exactly the same age they were when they first drank it. He uses the Philosopher's Stone formula to turn cheap copper and lead into gold and chunks of common coal into diamonds. He uses one of the most extraordinary collections of knowledge in the world, purely for personal gain. And that's the truth."
"But what about Skadi and Hecate? Are they elders?"
"Oh, absolutely. Hecate was an elder, and Skatok is next generation. But Hecate was a known criminal. She was banished from Danutalis because of her experiments on animals. I suppose you would call her a genetic engineer. She created the Were clans, for example, and loosed the curse of the werewolf onto humanity. I believe you saw some of her experiments yesterday, the boar people. Skatok is nothing more than a hired thug, cursed for her crimes to wear the body of a teen for the rest of her days. When Flamel knew I was closing in, they were the only people he could go to."
Josh was now hopelessly confused. Who was telling the truth? Flamel or Dee? He was cold now. Night had not yet fully fallen, but a low mist had crept in over the town. The air smelled of damp earth and just the faintest hint of rotten eggs.
"What about you? Are you really working to bring back the elders?"
"Of course I am," Dee said, sounding surprised. "It is probably the single most important thing I can do for this world."
"Flamel says the elders, the Dark Elders he calls them, would destroy the world."
Dee shrugged. "Believe me when I tell you that he's lying to you. The elders would be able to change this world for the better."
Dee's fingers moved in the water, the ripples languid and mesmerizing. Startled, Josh saw images forming in the water, the pictures matching Dee's soothing words.
"In the ancient past, the earth was a paradise. It had an incredibly advanced technology, but the air was clean, the water pure, the seas unpolluted."
There was a rippling image of an island set under cloudless azure skies.
Endless fields of golden wheat marched into the distance. Trees were laden with an assortment of exotic fruit. Not only did the elder race shape this world, they even nudged a primitive hominid on the road to evolution. But the elders were driven out from this paradise by the foolish superstition of the mad Abraham and the spells in the Codex. The elders did not die. It takes a lot to kill one of the elder race. They simply waited. They knew that someday mankind would come to its senses and call them back to save the earth. Josh could not take his eyes off the sparkling water. Much of what Dee said sounded plausible. If we can bring them back, the elders have the powers and the abilities to reshape this world. They can make the deserts bloom. An image formed in the water, huge wind-blown desert dunes turning green with lush grass. Another image appeared. Josh was looking at the earth from space, just like Google Earth. A huge swirl of dense cloud had formed over the Gulf of Mexico, heading toward Texas. "They can control the weather," Dee said, and the storm dissipated. Dee's fingers moved, and there appeared the unmistakable image of a hospital ward with a long row of empty beds. "And they can cure disease. Remember, these beings were worshipped as gods because of their powers. And these are the ones Flamel is trying to stop us from bringing back to the world." It took Josh an age to form the single word question. Why? He couldn't work out why Flamel would want to prevent such obvious advances. "Because he has masters. Elders like Hecate and the Witch of Endor, for example, who want the world to dissolve into chaos and anarchy. When that happens, they can come out of the shadows and declare themselves the rulers of the earth." Dee shook his head sadly. "It pains me to say this, but Flamel does not care about you, nor does he care about your sister. He put her in terrible danger today simply to roughly awaken her powers. The elders I work with take 3 days to bring someone through the awakening ceremony."
3 days, Josh mumbled.
"Flamel said there was no one else in North America who could awaken me."
He didn't want to believe Dee, and yet everything the man said sounded so reasonable.
"Another lie. My elders could awaken you. And they would do it properly and safely. It is, after all, such a dangerous process."
Dee got up slowly and walked around to crouch beside Josh, bringing his eyes level with the boy's face. Fog was beginning to thicken and swirl around the fountain, shifting and eddying as he moved. Dee's voice was silky smooth, a gentle monotone exactly in sync with the rippling water.
"What's your name?"
"Josh."
"Josh," Dee echoed. "Where is Nicholas Flamel now?"
Even in his drowsy state, an alarm bell, very faint and very, very distant, went off in Josh's head. He couldn't trust Dee. He shouldn't trust Dee. And yet so much of what he said had the ring of truth to it.
"Where is he, Josh?"
Dee persisted. Josh started to shake his head. Even though he believed Dee, everything he said made perfect sense. He wanted to talk to Sophie first. He needed to get her advice and opinion.
"Tell me."
Dee lifted Josh's limp hand and placed it in the pool. Ripples spun out from it. They settled into the image of a small antiques shop filled with glassware directly across the road from Libby Park. Grinning triumphantly, Dee came to his feet and whirled around, staring across the road as he activated his senses. He located their auras immediately. The green of Flamel, the gray of Skatok, Endor's brown, and the girl's pure silver. He had them, and this time there would be no mistakes, no escape.
"You sit here and enjoy the pretty pictures," Dee murmured, patting Josh on the shoulder.
The water bloomed with exotic, fractal-like patterns, mesmerizing and hypnotic.
"I'll be back for you shortly."
Then, without moving a muscle, he called in his waiting army. Abruptly, the fog thickened and darkened, stinking of rotten eggs and something else. Dust and dry earth, damp and mold. And horror descended on Ojai.
Chapter 38.
Nicholas Flamel's hands were already beginning to glow with green light when he pulled open the door of the small shop, grimacing in annoyance as the bell jangled merrily. The sun had dipped below the horizon while the witch worked with Sophie, and a chill fog had rolled down the valley. It swirled and rolled the length of Ojai Avenue, curling and twisting through the trees, leaving everything it touched beaded with moisture. Cars crept along, their headlights outlined in huge halos of light barely able to penetrate the gloom. The street was completely deserted. The people outside had all been dressed for summer weather and had fled indoors away from the damp. Scatty joined Flamel at the door. She carried a short sword in one hand, a nunchaku in the other, dangling loosely on its chain.
"This is not good. Not good at all," she breathed deeply. "Smell that."
Flamel nodded. "Sulfur. The odor of D." Scatty rattled the nunchaku.
"He's really starting to annoy me."
Somewhere in the distance, there was a metallic bang as two cars collided. A car alarm echoed forlornly behind them, and there was a scream, high-pitched and terrifying, and then another, and another. "It's coming, whatever it is," Nicholas Flamel said grimly.
"We don't want to be trapped here," Scatty said. "Let's find Josh and get back to the car."
"Agreed. He who retreats lives longer." He turned to look back into the shop. The Witch of Endor had Sophie by the arm and was whispering urgently to her. Wisps of white smoke still curled off the girl, and tendrils of white air dripped from her fingers like unwound bandages. Sophie leaned forward and kissed the old woman on the cheek. Then she turned and hurried down the length of the shop.
"We have to go," she said breathlessly. "We have to get away from here."
She had no idea what lay outside, but her newfound knowledge enabled her imagination to populate the fog with any number of monstrous creatures.
"And close the door behind you," the witch called out.
And at that moment, all the lights flickered and died. Ojai was plunged into darkness. The bell jangled as the trio stepped out into the now deserted street. The fog had become so thick that drivers had been forced to pull off the road, and there was no longer traffic moving on the main street. An air of unnatural silence had fallen. Flamel turned to Sophie. "Can you pinpoint Josh?"
"He said he'd wait for us in the park."
She squinted, trying to penetrate the fog, but it was so thick that she could barely see a foot in front of her face. With Flamel and Scatty on either side of her, she stepped off the sidewalk and made her way to the middle of the empty road.
"Josh?"
The fog swallowed her words, muffling them to little more than a whisper.
"Josh?"
she called again. There was no response. A
sudden thought struck her, and she flung out her right hand, fingers splayed. A puff of air curled from her hand, but did nothing to the fog except make it swirl and dance. She tried again, and an icy gale whipped across the street, cutting a neat corridor through the fog, catching the rear wing of an abandoned car in the middle of the road, leaving a ragged indentation in the metal.
"Whoops! I guess I have to practice," she muttered.
A shape stepped into the opening in the fog, and then a second and a third, and none of them were alive. Closest to Sophie, Flamel, and Scatty was a complete skeleton, standing tall and straight, wearing the ragged remains of the blue uniform coat of a U.S. cavalry officer. It carried the rusted stump of a sword and bony fingers. When it turned its head toward them, the bones at the base of its skull popped and cracked.
"Necromancy," Flamel breathed. "D's raised the dead."
Another figure loomed out of the fog. It was the partially mummified body of a man carrying a huge railroad hammer. Behind it came another dead man, whose remaining flesh was tanned to the consistency of leather. A pair of withered leather gun belts was slung low across his hips, and when he saw the group, he reached for the missing guns with skeletal fingers. Sophie stood frozen in shock, and the wind died away from her fingers.
"They're dead," she whispered. "Skeletons. Mummies. They're all dead."
"Yep,"
Skatok said matter-of-factly.
"Skeletons and mummies. It depends on what type of ground they were buried in. Damp soil, you get skeletons."
She stepped forward and swept out with a nunchaku, knocking the head clear off another gunslinger, who'd been attempting to raise a rusted rifle to his shoulder. "Dry soil, you get the mummies. Doesn't stop them from hurting you, though." The skeletal cavalry officer with the broken sword lashed out at her, and she parried with her own sword. His rusted blade dissolved into dust. Scatty's sword swung again and separated the head from the body, which then immediately crumpled to the ground. Although the shambling figures moved in complete silence, there were screams all around now. And even though they were muffled by the fog, fear and abject terror were clearly audible in them. The ordinary citizens of Ojai had become aware that the dead were walking through their streets. The fog was now thick with the creatures. They came from all sides, crowding in on the trio, encircling them in the center of the road. As the twisting sheets of dampness eddied and flowed, more and more skeletal and mummified remains were revealed in brief glimpses. Soldiers in the tattered blues and grays of Civil War uniforms. Farmers in rags of old-fashioned overalls. Cowboys in worn chaps and torn denim. Women in long, sweeping skirts, now moldy and ragged. Miners in threadbare buckskins.
"He's emptied a Boot Hill graveyard from one of the old abandoned towns," Scatty exclaimed, standing with her back to Sophie, striking out around her. "No one's here in clothes made after 1880.
Two skeletal women, wearing matching bonnets and the rags of their Sunday best, clicked their way on bony feet across Ojai Avenue toward her, arms outstretched. Scatty's sword whipped around, slicing away the arms, but that didn't even slow them down. She shoved her nunchaku back into her belt and pulled out her second sword. She struck out again, both swords forming an X in the middle of the air, and lopped off both heads, sending them bouncing back into the fog. The skeletons crumpled into a disarray of bones.
"Josh!" Sophie called again, her voice high in desperation. "Josh, where are you?"
Maybe the mummies and skeletons had gotten to him first. Maybe he was going to loom up out of the fog any minute, eyes blank and staring, head twisted at an awkward angle. She shook her head, trying to clear the ghoulish thoughts. Flamel's hands burned with cold green fire, and the damp fog was rich with the odor of mint. He snapped his fingers and sent a sheet of virescent fire blazing into the fog. The fog banks glowed emerald and aquamarine, but otherwise the magic had no effect. Flamel next threw a small ball of green light directly in front of two lurching skeletons who loomed up before him. Fire blazed over the creatures, crisping the remains of their gray Confederate uniforms. They continued forward, bones clacking on the street, closing in on him, and there were hundreds more behind them.
"Sophie, get the witch. We need her help."
"But she can't help us," Sophie said desperately. "There's nothing more she can do. She has no power left. She has given everything to me."
"Everything?"
Flamel gasped, ducking beneath a swinging fist. He placed his hand on the center of the dead man's ribcage and pushed, sending the skeleton flying back into the crowd where it fell in a tangle of bones.
"Well then, Sophie, you do something."
"What?" she called. What could she do against an army of the undead? She was a 15-year-old girl.
"Anything."
A mummified arm shot out of the fog and cracked her across the shoulder. It was like being hit by a wet towel. Fear, revulsion, and anger lent her strength. Right at that moment, however, she couldn't remember anything the witch had taught her. But then her instincts, or maybe the witch's imparted knowledge, took over. She deliberately allowed her anger to surge into her aura. Abruptly, the air was filled with the richness of creamy vanilla as Sophie's aura blazed pure silver. Bringing the palm of her right hand up to her face, she blew into her cupped fingers, then tossed the captured breath into the middle of the dead. A 6-foot-tall whirlwind, a miniature twister, appeared, growing up out of the ground. It sucked the dead nearest to it into its core, grinding and shattering the bones, then spitting out the splintered remains. Sophie threw a second and then a third ball of air. The three twisters danced and moved among the skeletons and mummies, cutting a swath of destruction through them. She found she could direct the twisters by simply looking in a particular direction, and they would obediently drift that way. Suddenly, Dee's voice echoed out of the fog.
Do you like my army, Nicholas?
The fog flattened the sound, making it impossible to locate.
The last time I was in Ojai, oh, over 100 years ago, I discovered a marvelous little graveyard just below the Three Sisters Peaks. The town it was built alongside is long gone, but the graves and their contents remain.
Flamel was fighting frantically as fists punched, fingernails scratched, feet kicked. There was no real strength to the skeleton's blows or the mummy's slaps, but what they lacked in force, they made up for in numbers. There were simply too many of them. There was a bruise beginning to darken beneath his eye and a long scratch on the back of his hand. Scatty moved around Sophie, defending her while she controlled the whirlwinds.
I don't know how long that graveyard was in use. A couple of 100 years, certainly. I've no idea how many corpses it holds. Hundreds, maybe even thousands. And, Nicholas, I've called them all.
Where is he? Flamel said through gritted teeth. He's got to be close, very close, to be able to control this number of corpses. I need to know where he is to do anything.
Sophie felt a wave of exhaustion wash over her, and suddenly one of the twisters wobbled and then vanished. The two that remained were weaving from side to side as Sophie's physical strength ebbed. Another died, and the one that remained was rapidly losing power. This exhaustion was the price of performing magic, she realized. But she needed to keep going for just a little longer. She had to find her brother.
We've got to get out of here. Skatok caught Sophie and held her upright.
The skeletal dead surged forward, and Scatty beat them back with neat, precise movements of her sword.
Josh, Sophie whispered tiredly. Where's Josh? We've got to find Josh.
The fog robbed Dee's voice of much of its emotion, but the glee in his tone was evident when he said,
And do you know what else I've discovered? These mountains have been luring creatures other than humans for the past millennia. The land here is littered with bones, hundreds of bones.
And remember, Nicholas, I am, first and foremost, a necromancer.
The bear that loomed up out of the gray fog bank was at least 8 feet tall, and even though patches of fur remained on its skeleton, it was clear that it had died a long time before. The snow-white bones only emphasized its huge, dagger-like claws. Behind the bear, the skeleton of a saber-toothed tiger appeared, and then a cougar, and another bear, smaller this time, and not quite as decomposed.
A word from me stops them, Dee's voice boomed. I want the pages of the Codex.
No, Flamel said grimly. Where is he? Where is he hiding?
Where's my brother?
Sophie called desperately, and then screamed as a dead hand wrapped itself in her hair. Skatok chopped it off at the wrist, but it still hung tangled in her hair like a bizarre hair clip.
What have you done with my brother?
Your brother is considering his options. Yours is not the only side in this battle. And now, since I have the boy, all I need are the pages.
Never!
The bear and the tiger charged through the crowd of bodies, brushing them aside, trampling them in their eagerness to get to the trio. The saber-toothed tiger reached them first. Its gleaming skeletal head was massive, and the two downward-jutting teeth were at least 8 inches long. Flamel placed himself between Sophie and the creature.
Hand over the pages, Nicholas, or I will loose these undead beasts on the town.
Nicholas frantically hunted through his memory for a spell that would stop the creature. He bitterly regretted now not studying more magic. He snapped his fingers, and a tiny bubble of light popped onto the ground in front of the tiger.
Is that all you can manage, Nicholas? My, you're weakening.
The bubble burst and spread across the ground in a cool emerald stain.
He's close enough to see us, Nicholas said. All I need is one glimpse of him.
The skeletal tiger's massive right paw stepped into the green light and stuck. It attempted to lift its leg, but thick strands of sticky green threads connected it to the road, and now its left paw stepped into the light and stuck.
Not quite so weak, eh, Dee?
Flamel shouted. But the press of bodies behind the saber-toothed tiger kept pushing it forward. Suddenly, its bony legs snapped off,
sending the huge beast lunging forward. Flamel managed to throw up his arms before the monster collapsed on top of him, jaw gaping, teeth wide and savage.
"Goodbye, Nicholas Flamel," Dee called.
"I'll just take the pages from your body."
"No," Sophie whispered.
No, it was not going to end like this. She had been awakened, and the Witch of Endor had imbued her with all her knowledge. There had to be something she could do. Sophie opened her mouth and screamed, her aura blazing with silver incandescence.
Chapter 39. Josh awoke, his sister's scream ringing in his ears. It took him several seconds before he realized where he was, sitting on the edge of the fountain in Libby Park, while all around him thick, foul-smelling banks of fog shifted and twisted and crawled with half-glimpsed skeletons and mummified bodies clothed in rags.
Sophie!
He had to get to his sister. To his right, in the middle of the gray-black fog, green light sparkled and silver flared, briefly illuminating the mist from within, casting monstrous shadows. Sophie was there, Flamel and Skatok too, fighting these monsters. He should be with them. He came shakily to his feet and discovered Dr. John Dee standing directly in front of him. Dee was outlined in a sickly yellow aura. It sparked and spat and hissed like burning fat and gave off the rancid odor of rotten eggs. The man had his back to him. He was leaning both forearms against the low stone wall next to the drinking fountain Josh had used earlier. Dee was staring intently at the events taking place in the street, concentrating so hard he was shaking with the effort of controlling the seemingly endless line of skeletons and mummified humans shuffling past. Now that he was on his feet, Josh noticed that there were other creatures in the fog, too. He could see the remains of bears and tigers, mountain cats and wolves. He heard Flamel shout and Sophie scream, and his first thought was to rush at Dee. But he doubted he'd even get close. What could he do against this powerful magician? He wasn't like his twin. He had no powers. But that didn't mean he was useless. Sophie's scream sent out a shockwave of icy air that shattered the saber-toothed tiger to powder and knocked back the nearest skeletons. The huge bear crashed to the ground, crushing a dozen skeletons beneath its bulk. The blast of air had also cleared away a patch of fog, and for the first time, Sophie realized the enormity of what they were facing. There weren't dozens or even hundreds. There were thousands of the Old West's dead marching down the street toward them. Dotted through the mass were the bony remains of the animals that had hunted in the surrounding mountains for centuries. She didn't know what else she could do. The final use of magic exhausted her, and she slumped against Skatok, who caught her in her left arm while holding one sword in her right hand. Flamel climbed tiredly to his feet. Using magic had drained his reserves of energy as well, and even in the past few minutes, he had aged. The lines around his eyes were deeper, his hair thinner. Skatok knew he could not survive much longer.
"Give him the pages, Nicholas," she urged.
He shook his head stubbornly.
"I will not. I cannot. I've spent my life protecting the book."
"He who retreats lives longer," she reminded him.
He shook his head. Flamel was bent over, breathing in great, heaving gulps of air. His skin was deathly pale, with two spots of unnaturally bright red on his cheeks.
"This is the exception, Skatok. If I give him the pages, then I've condemned all of us, Perry too, and the entire world to destruction."
He straightened and turned to face the creatures, for what they all knew would be the last time.
"Could you get Sophie away from here?"
Skatok shook her head.
"I cannot fight them and carry her."
"Could you get away on your own?"
"I could fight my way out," she said carefully.
"Then go, Skatty. Escape. Get to the other elders. Contact the immortal humans. Tell them what happened here. Start fighting the Dark Elders before it is too late."
"I'll not leave you and Sophie here," Skatok said firmly. "We're in this together to the end, whatever that may be."
"It's time to die, Nicholas Flamel," Dee called out of the gloom. "I'll make sure to tell Perronel about this moment in every little detail." A rustle ran through the mass of skeletal human and animal bodies, and then, as one, they surged forward. And a monster came out of the fog. Huge and black, howling savagely, with two huge yellow-white eyes and dozens of smaller eyes blazing, it drove straight through the Libby Park fountain, crushing it to powder, shattering the ornamental vases, and bore down on Dr. John Dee. The necromancer managed to fling himself to one side before the black Hummer crashed into the wall, pounding it to dust. It struck nose down against the remains of the wall, back wheels caught in the air, engine screaming. The door opened, and Josh climbed out and carefully lowered himself to the ground. He was holding his chest where the seatbelt had cut into it. Ojai Avenue was littered with the remains of the long dead. Without Dee to control them, they were just so many bones. Josh staggered into the street and picked his way through the bones and scraps of cloth. Something crunched beneath his feet, but he didn't even look down. Suddenly, the dead were gone. Sophie didn't know what had happened. There had been a tremendous roar, a scream of tortured metal, and a crunch of stone, and then silence. And in the silence, the dead had fallen down like wind-blown grass. What had Dee summoned now? A shape moved in the twisting fog. Flamel gathered the last of his energy into a solid sphere of green glass. Sophie straightened and tried to muster the dregs of her energy. Skatok flexed her fingers. She'd once been told that she'd die in an exotic location. She wondered if Ojai in Ventura County qualified as exotic enough. The shape loomed closer. Flamel raised his hand. Sophie gathered the winds, and Skatok lifted her notched sword. Josh stepped out of the night. "I've wrecked the car," he said. Sophie screamed with delight. She ran to her brother, and then her scream turned to one of horror. The skeletal bear had risen from the ground behind him, paws poised to strike. Skatok moved, hitting Josh hard, shoving him out of the way, and sent him tumbling into a mess of bones. The warrior's swords parried the bear's sweeping blow, sparks blinking in the fog. She struck out again, and a bear claw as long as her hand tumbled through the air. One by one, the skeletal animals were climbing to their feet. Two huge wolves, one little more than bones, the other merely shriveled flesh, loomed out of the fog.
"This way! Here! This way!"
The witch's voice sounded flatly across the street, and a rectangle of light from an open door lit up the night. With Scatty supporting Flamel and Josh half carrying his twin, they raced across the street toward the shop. The Witch of Endor was standing in the doorway, looking blindly into the night, an old-fashioned oil lantern held high.
"We've got to get you out of here."
She pulled the door closed and pushed the bolts home.
"That won't hold them long," she muttered.
You said you have no powers left," Sophie muttered.
"I don't."
Dora flashed a quick grin, revealing perfect white teeth.
"But this place has."
She led them through the shop and into a tiny back room.
"Do you know what makes Ojai so special?" she asked.
Something thumped against the door, and all the glassware in the shop rattled and tinkled.
"It is built on an intersection of ley lines."
Josh opened his mouth and was actually forming the word "ley" when his sister spoke.
"Lines of energy that crisscross the globe,"
Sophie whispered in his ear.
"How do you know that?"
"I don't know. I guess the witch taught me. Many of the most famous buildings and ancient sites across the world are built where the ley lines meet."
"Exactly," Dora said, sounding pleased. "Couldn't have put it better myself."
The little storeroom was bare except for a long rectangle propped up against the wall, covered in yellowed back issues of the Ojai Valley Times. More blows shook the shop window, the sound of bone against glass setting them on edge. Dora swept the papers to the ground to reveal a mirror. It stood 7 feet tall, 4 feet wide, the glass dirty, speckled and warped.
the images it showed slightly distorted and blurred. "And do you know what drew me to Ojai in the first place?" she asked. "Seven great ley lines meet here. They form a ley gate."
"Here?"
Flamel whispered. He knew about ley lines and had heard about the ley gates used by the ancients to travel across the world in an instant. He hadn't thought any still existed. Dora tapped the ground with her foot.
"Right here. And do you know how to use a ley gate?"
Flamel shook his head. Dora reached for Sophie. "Give me your hand, child." The witch took Sophie's hand and put it on the glass. "You use a mirror." The mirror immediately came to blazing life, the glass flaring silver and then clearing. When they looked into the glass, it no longer showed their reflections, but rather the image of a bare, cellar-like room.
"Where?"
Flamel asked.
"Paris,"
Dora said.
"France,"
he smiled.
"Home."
And without hesitation, he stepped right through the glass. Now they could see him within the mirror. He turned and waved them through.
"I hate ley gates,"
Scatty muttered.
"Make me nauseous."
She hopped through the gate and rolled to her feet beside Flamel. When she turned back to face the twins, she did look as if she was about to throw up. The skeletal bear lumbered straight through the shop door, ripping it off its hinges. The wolves and the cougars followed. Glassware tumbled, mirrors cracked, ornaments shattered as the beasts lumbered about. A bruised and cut D raced into the shop, pushing the skeletal beasts aside. A cougar snapped at him, and he smacked it on the snout. If it had had eyes, it would have blinked in surprise.
"Trapped," he called gleefully. "Trapped, and nowhere to go."
But when he stepped into the storeroom, he knew they had escaped him once more. It took him a single heartbeat to take in the tall mirror, the two figures in the glass staring out, the old woman standing next to the girl, pressing her hand to its surface. The boy stood alone, holding on to the frame. Dee instantly knew what it was.
"A ley gate,"
he whispered in awe. Mirrors always acted as the gates. Somewhere at the other end of the ley line was another mirror linking them. The old woman caught the girl and shoved her through the mirror. Sophie tumbled to the ground at Flamel's feet, then crouched to turn and look back. Her mouth moved, but there was no sound.
"Josh."
"Josh," Dee commanded, staring at the boy. "Stay where you are." The boy turned to the glass. Already the image in the mirror had blurred.
"I've told you the truth about Flamel," Dee said urgently. All he had to do was to keep the boy distracted for another moment or two, and the mirror would lose its power. "Stay with me. I can awaken you, make you powerful. You can help change the world, Josh. Change it for the better."
"I don't know."
The offer was tempting, so tempting. But he knew if he sided with Dee, he would lose his sister altogether. Or would he? If Dee awakened him, then they would be alike again. Maybe this was a way he could reconnect with his twin.
"Look," Dee said triumphantly, pointing to the fading image in the glass. "They've left you, deserted you again, because you are not one of them. You're no longer important."
The mirror flared silver, and Sophie stepped back through the glass.
"Josh, hurry,"
she said urgently, not looking at Dee.
"I,"
he began.
"You came back for me."
"Of course I did. You're my brother. I'll never abandon you." Then, catching his hand, wrapping her fingers around his, she pulled him into the glass. And Dora pushed the mirror, sending it shattering to the floor.
"Whoops."
She turned to face Dee and pulled off her dark glasses to reveal the mirrors of her eyes.
"You should go now. You've got about 3 seconds.
Dee didn't quite make it out of the shop before it exploded. Chapter 40. Movie company causes mayhem in scenic Ojai. The latest in a long line of horror movies from Enoch Studios caused traffic mayhem and more than a little confusion in downtown Ojai yesterday.
The special effects were a bit too realistic for some locals, and emergency services were inundated with calls from people who claimed that the dead were walking the streets. John Dee, chairman of Enoch Films, a division of Enoch Enterprises, apologized profusely for the confusion, blaming it on a power outage and an unseasonable fog that swept in as they were about to shoot a scene from their new movie. "It certainly made the extras look extra scary," his spokesman said. In a related incident, a drunk driver smashed through the historic Libby Park fountain and into the recently restored pergola. Dee has promised to restore the fountain and pergola to their former glory. Ojai Valley News. Local antiques shop devastated by explosion. A gas explosion destroyed the shop of longtime Ojai resident Dora Witcherly late last night. An electrical fault ignited solvents used by the owner to clean, polish, and restore her antiques. Miss Witcherly was in the shop's back room when the explosion occurred and was unharmed and apparently unconcerned by her brush with death. "When you've lived as long as I have, nothing much surprises you." She has promised to reopen the shop in time for the holidays. Ojai Online. Chapter 41. Deep beneath Alcatraz, Perrineau Flamel lay on a narrow cot, her face turned toward the back wall of her cell. Behind her, in the corridor outside, she could hear the Sphinx click-clacking up and down the cold stone floors, and the air was heavy with the musky odors of snake and lion. Perrineau shivered. The cell was freezing, and green-tinged water was dripping down the wall inches from her face. Where was Nicholas? What was happening? Perrineau was afraid, but not for herself. The fact that she was alive meant that Dee needed her for something, and that sooner or later she would come face to face with him. And if Dee had a failing, it was arrogance. He would underestimate her, and then she would strike. There was a particularly nasty little spell she had learned in the foothills of the Carpathian Mountains in Transylvania that she was saving just for him.
Where was Nicholas?
She was afraid for Nicholas and the children. It was difficult for her to judge just how much time had passed, but by examining the wrinkles forming on the backs of her hands, she guessed she'd aged at least 2 years, so 2 days had passed. Without the immortality elixir, she and Nicholas would age at the rate of a year a day. They had less than a month left before they succumbed to old, very old, age. And with no one to stand against them, Dee and the others like him would loose the Dark Elders into the world again. It would be chaos. Civilization would fall.
Where was Nicholas?
Perrineau blinked away tears. She wasn't going to give the Sphinx the satisfaction of seeing her weep. The elders had nothing but contempt for human emotion. They considered it their biggest weakness. Perrineau knew it was humankind's greatest strength. She blinked again, and it took her a moment to realize what she was seeing. The foul dripping water running down the walls had briefly curled and formed into a pattern. She focused, trying to make sense of what she was seeing. The liquid twisted and coiled into a face. Jefferson Miller, the ghost of the security guard. The dribbling water bent into letters on the moss-streaked walls. Flamel. Children. The words lasted less than a heartbeat before they flowed away. Safe. Now Perrineau had to blink hard to clear her eyes. Flamel and the children were safe. Ojai. Legate, Paris.
Thank you,
Perrineau mouthed silently as Jefferson Miller's face dissolved and ran liquid down the wall. She had so many questions, but at least now she had some answers. Nicholas and the children were safe. They had obviously reached Ojai and met the Witch of Endor. She must have opened the legate to take them to Paris, and that suggested that the witch had helped them and had most likely instructed Sophie in the magic of air. Perrineau knew that the witch would not have been able to awaken Josh's powers, but in Paris and across Europe there were elders and immortal humans who would be able to help, who could awaken Josh and train both twins in the five elemental magics. She rolled over on her back
and looked at the Sphinx, which was now crouched outside her cell, human head resting on enormous lion's paws, wings folded across its back. The creature smiled lazily, long black forked tongue flickering.
"It is ending, immortal," the Sphinx whispered.
Perronel's smile was terrifying.
"On the contrary," she replied, "it is now only just beginning."
End of Book One. A special preview of The Magician, Book Two of The Secrets of the Immortal Nicholas Flamel.
"I am dying. Along with my wife, Perronel, I age a year for every day that passes, and thus, by my reckoning, we both have less than a month to live. But much can be achieved in a month.
D and his dark masters have Perronel prisoner. They have finally secured the Codex, the Book of Abraham the Mage, and they must also know that Perronel and I cannot survive for much longer. But they cannot be resting easy. They must know now that Sophie and Josh are the twins mentioned in the ancient book. They are the twins of prophecy and legend, with auras of silver and gold, brother and sister, with the power to either save the world or destroy it. The girl's powers have been awakened, though, sadly, the boys have not. Now we are in Paris, the city of my birth, the city where I first discovered the Codex and began the long quest to translate it. That journey led me to the discovery of the Elder Race, revealed the mystery of the Philosopher's Stone, and finally, the ultimate secret of immortality. I love this city. It holds many secrets and is home to more than one human immortal, an ancient elder. Here, I will find a way to awaken Josh's powers and continue Sophie's education. I must. For their sakes, and for the continuance of the human race." From the daybook of Nicholas Flamel, alchemist, writ this day Friday, 1st June, in Paris, the city of my youth.
Saturday, 2nd June. Chapter 1. The charity auction hadn't started until well after midnight, once the gala dinner had ended. It was almost 4 in the morning, and the auction was only now drawing to a close. A digital display behind the celebrity auctioneer, an actor who had played James Bond on screen for many years, showed the running total at more than 1 million euro.
"Lot number 210, a pair of early 19th century Japanese kabuki masks."
A ripple of excitement ran through the crowded room. Carved from solid jade, the kabuki masks were the highlight of the auction, and were expected to fetch in excess of 500,000 euro. The tall, thin man with the fuzz of close-cropped snow-white hair standing at the back of the room was prepared to pay twice that. Niccolò Machiavelli stood apart from the crowd, arms lightly folded across his chest, careful not to wrinkle his Savile Row-tailored black silk tuxedo. Stone-gray eyes swept over the other bidders, analyzing and assessing them. There were really only 5 he needed to look out for: 2 private collectors like himself, a minor European royal, an American movie actor who had been briefly famous in the 80s, and an antiques dealer who was probably bidding on behalf of a client. The remainder of the audience, a mixture of celebrities from the worlds of entertainment and sports, a sprinkling of politicians, and the usual people who turned up to support every charity event, were tired, had spent their budget, or were unwilling to bid on the vaguely disturbing-looking masks. Machiavelli had been collecting masks for a very long time, and he wanted this pair to complete his group of Japanese theater costumes. These masks had last come up for sale in 1898 in Vienna, and he had then been outbid by a Romanov prince. Machiavelli had patiently bided his time. He knew they would be put on the market again when the prince and his descendants died. Niccolò knew he would still be around to buy them. It was one of the many advantages of being immortal.
"Shall we start the bidding at 100,000 euro?
Machiavelli looked up, caught the auctioneer's attention, and nodded.
The auctioneer nodded in return. I am bid 100,000 euro by Monsieur Machiavelli, always one of this charity's most generous supporters and sponsors. Applause filled the room, and several people turned to look at him and raise their glasses. Niccolo acknowledged them with a polite nod. Do I have 110? The auctioneer asked. One of the private collectors raised his hand slightly. 120? The auctioneer looked back at Machiavelli, who immediately nodded. Within the next 3 minutes, a flurry of bids brought the price up to 250,000 euro. There were only 3 serious bidders left: Machiavelli, the American actor, and the antique dealer. Machiavelli's thin lips twisted into a rare smile. The masks would be his. And then the smile faded as he felt his cell phone buzz silently in his back pocket. For an instant, he was tempted to ignore it. He'd given his staff strict instructions that he was not to be disturbed unless it was an absolute emergency. He pulled out the ultra-slim Nokia and glanced down. A picture of a sword pulsed gently on the large LCD screen. Machiavelli's smile vanished completely. In that second, he knew he was not going to be able to buy the kabuki masks this century. Turning on his heel, he strode out of the room and pressed the phone to his ear. Behind him, he could hear the auctioneer's gavel hit the lectern. Sold for 260,000 euro. I'm here, Machiavelli said, reverting to the Italian of his youth. The connection popped and crackled, and then, from the other side of the world, in the city of Ojai, north of Los Angeles, an English-accented voice responded in the same language, using a dialect that had not been heard in Europe for more than 400 years. I need your help. The man on the other end of the line didn't identify himself, nor did he need to. Machiavelli knew it was the immortal magician and necromancer, Dr. John Dee, one of the most powerful and dangerous men in the world. Niccolo Machiavelli hurried out of the small hotel into the broad cobbled square of the Place du Tertre and stopped to breathe in the chill night air. What can I do for you? He asked cautiously. He detested Dee and knew the feeling was mutual, but they both served the Dark Elders, and that meant they had been forced to work together through the centuries. Machiavelli was also slightly envious that Dee was younger than he, and looked it. Machiavelli had been born in Florence in 1469, which made him 58 years older than the English magician. Flamel is back in Paris. Machiavelli straightened. When? Just now. He got there through a lay gate. I've no idea where it comes out. He's got Scatoc with him. Machiavelli's face twisted into an ugly grimace. The last time he'd encountered the warrior, she'd pushed him through a door. It had been closed at the time, and he'd spent nearly a month picking splinters from his chest and shoulders. He hadn't been able to sit down for a week. There are 2 Humani children with him, Americans, Dee said, voice echoing and fading on the transatlantic line. Twins, he added. Say again, Machiavelli asked. Twins, Dee snapped. With pure gold and silver auras, you know what that means, he said. Yes, Machiavelli muttered. It meant trouble. The girl's powers were awakened by Hecate before the goddess and her shadow realm were destroyed. I believe the Witch of Endor has instructed the girl in the magic of air. What do you want me to do? Machiavelli asked carefully, although he already had a very good idea. Find them, Dee snapped. Capture them. I'm on my way over there, but it's going to take me 14 or 15 hours to get to Paris. What happened to the lay gate? Machiavelli wondered aloud. Destroyed by the Witch of Endor, Dee said bitterly. And she nearly killed me, too. I was lucky to escape with a few cuts and scratches, he added, and then ended the call without saying goodbye. Niccolo Machiavelli closed his phone carefully and tapped it against his bottom lip. Somehow he doubted that Dee had been lucky. If the Witch of Endor had wanted him dead, then even the legendary Dr. Dee would not have escaped.
Machiavelli turned and walked across the square to where his driver was patiently waiting with the car. If Flamel, Skatok, and the American twins had come to Paris via a legate, then there were only a few places in the city where they could have landed. It should be relatively easy to find and capture them. If he could do it tonight, then he would have 15 hours to work on his captives before Dee arrived. And in that time, they would tell him everything they knew. Half a millennium on this earth had taught Niccolo Machiavelli how to be very persuasive indeed.
"Where exactly are we?" Josh Newman demanded, looking around, trying to make sense of what had just happened. One second, he'd been in the Witch of Endor's shop in Ojai, and the next, Sophie had pulled him through a mirror. There had been a chill of disorientation, and he'd squeezed his eyes shut. When he'd opened them again, he'd found he was standing in what looked like a tiny storage room. Pots of paints, stacked ladders, broken pieces of pottery, and bundled paint-spattered cloths were piled around a large, rather ordinary-looking, grimy mirror fixed to the stone wall. A single low-wattage bulb shed a dim, yellow light over the room.
"We're in Paris," Nicholas Flamel said delightedly. "The city of my birth."
"How?" Josh asked. He looked at his twin sister, but she had pressed her head to the room's only door and was listening intently. She waved him away. He looked at Skatok, but she just shook her head, both hands pressed to her mouth. She looked as if she was about to throw up.
"How did we get here?" he said to Flamel. "This earth is crisscrossed with invisible lines of power, sometimes called ley lines or cursus," Flamel explained. "Where two or more lines intersect, a gateway exists. Gates are incredibly rare now, but in ancient times, the elder race used them to travel from one side of the world to the other in an instant, just as we did. The witch opened the ley gate in Ojai, and we entered up here, in Paris."
"I hate them,"
Scatty mumbled. Even in the gloomy light, she looked green.
"You ever been seasick?"
she asked. Josh shook his head.
"Never."
Sophie lifted her head from the door.
"Josh gets seasick in a swimming pool."
She grinned, then pressed the side of her face back against the door.
"Seasick. That's exactly what it feels like. Only worse."
Sophie lifted her head to look at the alchemist.
"Do you have any idea where we are in Paris?"
"Someplace old," Flamel said, joining her at the door. Sophie shook her head and stepped back.
"I'm not so sure," she said.
With her awakened powers and the Witch of Endor's knowledge, she was struggling to make sense of the countless emotions and impressions surging within her. The building they were in didn't feel old, but as she listened carefully enough, she could actually hear the murmurs of countless ghosts. She touched the wall with the palm of her hand and was immediately able to distinguish gossamer threads of voices, whispered songs, distant organ music. She lifted her hand, and the sounds in her head faded.
"It's a church," she said, then frowned. "But it's a new church. Modern. Late 19th century, early 20th. But it's built on a much, much older site."
Flamel paused at the wooden door and looked over his shoulder. In the dim overhead light, his features were suddenly sharp and angular, disturbingly skull-like, his eyes completely in shadow.
"There are many churches in Paris," he said, "though there is only one, I believe, that matches that description," he added, reaching for the door handle.
"Hang on a second," Josh said quickly. "Don't you think there could be some sort of alarm?"
"Not at all," Nicholas Flamel said confidently. "Who would put an alarm in a church?"
He pulled the door open. Immediately, an alarm began to warble, the sound echoing off the flagstones and stone walls. Red security lights began to strobe.
"Let's get out of here," Flamel shouted over the shrieking alarm.
Sophie and Josh followed close behind. Scatty took up the rear, moving slowly and grumbling with every step. The door opened onto a narrow corridor that led to a second door. Without pausing, Flamel pushed through the second door, and immediately another alarm began to shriek. He turned left into a huge open space that smelled of old incense and wax.
Banks of lit candles shed a golden yellow light over walls and floor, and these, combined with the security lights, revealed a pair of enormous doors with the word exit above them. Flamel raced toward it.
"Don't touch,"
Josh started to say, but Nicholas Flamel grabbed the door handles and pulled hard. A third alarm went off, and a red light above the door began to wink on and off.
"I don't understand. Why is it not open?"
Flamel asked.
"This church is always open."
He turned and looked around.
"Where is everyone? What time is it?"
he asked.
"How long does it take to travel from one place to another through the Laygate?"
Sophie asked.
"It's instantaneous."
Sophie looked at her watch and did a quick calculation.
"Paris is 9 hours ahead of Ojai?"
she asked. Flamel nodded.
"It's now about 4 a.m. That's why the church is closed."
"The police will be on their way,"
Scatty said glumly. She reached for her nunchaku.
"I hate fighting when I'm not feeling well,"
she muttered.
"What do we do now?"
Josh demanded.
"I could try and blast the doors apart with my wind magic,"
Sophie suggested.
"I forbid it,"
Flamel shouted, his face shadowed and painted in shades of crimson by the light. He turned and pointed across rows of wooden pews to an ornate altar picked out in tracery of white marble. Candlelight hinted at a mosaic in glittering blues and golds in the dome over the altar.
"This is a national monument. I'll not let you destroy it."
"Where are we?"
the twins asked together, looking around the building. Now that their eyes had adjusted to the gloom, they could make out the outlines of small side altars, statues in nooks, and banks of candles. They could distinguish the columns soaring high into the shadow overhead. The building was huge.
"This is the Basilica of Sacré-Cœur."
Sitting in the back of his limousine, Niccolo Machiavelli tapped coordinates into his laptop and watched a high-resolution map of Paris wink into existence on the screen. Paris was an incredibly ancient city. Its first settlement went back more than 2,000 years, though there had been humans living on the island in the Seine for generations before that. And like many of the Earth's oldest cities, it had been sited where groups of ley lines met. Machiavelli hit a keystroke, which laid down a pattern of ley lines over the map of the city. He knew he needed a line that connected with the United States. After eliminating the lines that didn't run east to west, he finally managed to reduce the numbers of possibilities to 6. With a perfectly manicured fingernail, he traced 2 lines that directly linked the west coast of America to Paris. One ended at the great cathedral of Notre Dame, the other in the more modern but equally famous basilica of the Sacré-Cœur in Montmartre. But which line had Flamel used? Suddenly, the Parisian night was broken by a series of howling alarms. Machiavelli hit the control for the electric window, and the tinted glass whispered down. Cool night air swirled into the car. In the distance, visible over the rooftops on the opposite side of the Place du Tertre, the lights around Sacré-Cœur painted the imposing dome building in stark white light. Red alarm lights pulsed around the building. That one. Machiavelli's smile was terrifying. He called up a program on the laptop and waited while the hard drive spun. Enter password. His fingers flew over the keyboard as he typed, "Discorsi sopra la prima decca di Tito Livio." No one was going to break that password. It wasn't one of his better-known books. A rather ordinary-looking text document appeared, written in a combination of Latin, Greek, and Italian. At one time, magicians had had to keep their spells and incantations in handwritten books called grimoires. Machiavelli had always used the latest technology. These days, he preferred to keep his on his hard drive. Now he just needed a little something to keep Flamel and his friends busy.
"I hear sirens," Josh said, his face pressed against the wooden door.
"There are 12 police cars headed this way,"
Sophie said, her head tilted to one side, eyes closed as she listened intently. Her brother was suddenly reminded of the extent of his sister's awakened powers. All of her senses were enhanced.
She could see and hear beyond the range of ordinary humans like him.
"We cannot be captured by the police," Flamel said desperately. "We have no passports, no money, and no alibi. We've got to get out of here."
"How?"
the twins asked simultaneously.
Flamel shook his head.
"There has to be another entrance," he began, and then stopped, nostrils flaring.
Josh watched both Sophie and Scatty react to something he could not smell.
"What?
What is it?"
he demanded, and then he suddenly caught the faintest whiff of something musky and rank. It was the sort of smell he associated with a zoo.
"Trouble," Scatok said grimly, pushing away her nunchaku and drawing her swords.
"Big trouble."
This is Dennis O'Hare. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Alchemist, The Secrets of the Immortal Nicholas Flamel by Michael Scott. This program was produced and directed by John McElroy. Executive producer, Dan Zitt. This program was recorded at CDM Studios. Text copyright 2007 by Michael Scott. Production copyright 2007, Random House Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.